Civil Attorney. I'm very glad to be here. I have just wonderful warm memories of Etta, and I'm thinking how much she would have enjoyed the work I've been doing and the talking and the arguing that I've been having with various people about this subject. It's a very mixed subject. I was, when Esther asked me, I knew I was going to be in Washington, D.C., and why I was there was I was working at the Folger Shakespeare Library. And I was working, I went there to work on revenge tragedy, try to find out why there is such a cluster of revenge plays. And the one you all know probably is Hamlet. I mean, there's lots of others, but oh, thank you so much. but I wondered why in the end of the 16th century and the beginning of the 17th, there was such a cluster of these plays. Why were they so popular? What was going on? And one of the current literary theories, one of the current cultural theories that people are studying in humanities departments is trying to find some way to describe what was the surround, what was going on in the plays and what was going on in the culture without saying that the plays reflect what's going on in the culture. Okay? I mean, because there doesn't seem to be any reason for plays to reflect things. It seems to be, you know, nobody would know why they would do that. And what are they doing? What is the work of the plays that all of a sudden you need so many of them at this point? So what I was doing was legal history. And I'm glad to say, I know there are some lawyers here. That's going to be fun, part of the fun, too. So I worked at the Folger Library. I read a lot of 16th century legal documents and history, and I read some plays. And on Shabbat, I listened to the Parsha, of course, and unsurprisingly, I found a connection between all of my texts. So what you're going to hear about tonight is some comments on my 753rd project designed to assure me that modern humanist scholarship is compatible with modern orthodoxy. In between my stays in Washington, my dear son Josh either encourages me with insights from his own work or leads me into the next trap, the one I haven't seen yet and I'm about to fall into. So as he promised me, this audience will all do that. I have more than just him. naturally, I succeeded in finding some interesting connections between traditional interpretations and some of the exciting new directions of thinking about justice, which I'd like to share with you this evening. I trust you not to object to my unusual mix of references. Some of my sources are legal history or theory. Some are hypotheses from cognitive science. Some from Shakespeare. Almost all the sources from rabbinical literature are via Josh, who I know I'll embarrass now by saying how much we appreciate him in our family for keeping our intellectual life balanced between Jewishness and Goyishness. And that compliment serves to introduce the cognitive science part of my topic, namely balance. The Jewish part is the law, okay, and the other part is balance. Okay? But I can at least begin conventionally at the interpretation of Sefer Shmot, and I actually will end conventionally proposing a new interpretation of what the meaning of those first three events in Moshe's life as a grown-up. Remember back in a few weeks ago, there are three events in the life of Moshe. So Sefer Shmot is conventionally considered the record of the formation of the Jewish people, beginning with their redemption from slavery. God's plan seems set for three events in quick succession: an end to slavery brought about by the physical exodus, the receiving the law at Sinai, and settling down to live according to the law in their own land. Of course, it doesn't quite happen this way, but it was a good idea. It was an excellent idea. From the perspective of cognitive evolutionary anthropology, which I'll mention why, and it was still a good idea even though the realization was delayed. The reason it was a good idea to use a legal term to start with is that it brought the Jewish people into their own jurisdiction. Okay? Jurisdiction is a legal term referring to the physical space in which any specified laws apply. It's a very complicated issue in England in the 16th century. For example, they had special courts. You could have a court in England in the 16th century on a manor, just that a court could be just for the manor. There was an admiralty court for things that happened on the high seas. There were at every single place. And the issue of jurisdiction was incredibly difficult at that time. And also, this I found interesting, and you just have to come from Israel to appreciate this. Nobody in the Folger did. That right after the Reformation, the secular courts, the common law courts, and all other kinds of courts were interested in getting their hands on the business that the ecclesiastical courts had previously, the Roman ecclesiastical courts had previously handled. And so there was a lot of poaching going on, and they tried fighting over jurisdictions, but nobody knew what I was talking about, and who should judge on what kinds of things. But, for example, what had been considered in the ecclesiastical court as the sin of breaking a vow was taken over by the secular courts, and they said, no, it's just a question of debt. You know, you owe a debt. You didn't give the money back. You stole. That's it. No. And so they redefined a lot of crimes out of the ecclesiastical realm into the secular realm. That's just an issue of jurisdiction. That's what they were fighting about. So jurisdiction being the physical space in which the laws apply, and it has an important resonance with Zionism also, but that's for another time. Now I want to keep on track talking about God's plan to move the Jews out of a situation in which they were living as slaves, a situation in which even Moshe was an outlaw. A status I'll explain in a minute, and bring them into their own law and their own land in terms of cultural evolution. This is a significant step up, to have a law and to be in a place where it applies, and I'll expand on that. So now I see two jobs that I have. First, I want to expand on the notion of living outside the law, and then I'll move on to the advantages of living with law, by the law. Let me make clear what an outlaw is by a couple of examples. Lahavdil, I'd say everybody know Huck Finn. Remember Huck Finn? Well, he gets tired of living according to the laws of fussy Aunt Polly, the mostly good table manners is what she demands. And he decides to leave the house, and he says, I'll live out for the territory. Okay? Because remember, at that time, beyond the Mississippi River is out of the jurisdiction, certainly out of Aunt Polly's jurisdiction. And he doesn't have to follow any laws there, okay? In the territories beyond the Mississippi River, American law didn't apply, so he becomes an outlaw. He lives outside the jurisdiction. But a more honorable one might be, you all know also, Robin Hood, right? Okay? And he is literally an outlaw because he's too far north. He's in the place in the British Isles where the law doesn't apply, but they make their own law. Okay, now this you also know, those of you who watch The Sopranos know that, you know, outlaws make their own laws. And the law, you also know what Robin Hood's law was, right? Steal from the rich and give to the poor. Okay, so that was the law where he lived. The law of the outlaws, we know from the Wild West. I was really hoping everybody could go and see True Grit before tonight. Really wonderful example of this. The outlaw law is simpler, it's more primitive than civil law, it's unwritten, it's unsophisticated, it's unsubtle, and although there is a veneer of morality, the real basic law beyond the borders of an acknowledged jurisdiction is might makes right. I mean, that's pretty much the way it goes. Sometimes they try to justify it a little better. But it isn't. It's what you can get away with is yours. It's
Highwaymen?
They should be within the law. You just can't catch them. I think that, yeah. No. But extraterritorial law is more violent than courtroom law. It's enforced by violence, and it's a bodily law. It's bodily. It's embodied. It has to do with how strong you are. To put it another way, there's nothing transcendental about it, about this law. And this is interesting, the first connection to Shmot 12, where the first hint that Moshe is an outlaw is that all three stories are about him physically doing something with his body. Didn't even say anything, doesn't say any words. The first one, he kills the Egyptian and buries him. The second one, he separates the two. I suppose it's implied that he speaks to them. He's actually literally, they speak to him, I know. He also speaks to them? Okay. And then in the third one, he pushes away the people who, he pushes the shepherds away so that the daughters in Midian, when he's already in Midian. So he has nothing else to go on. He doesn't have anything but his body. He hasn't got a group. He hasn't got a jurisdiction. He doesn't part of anything where he can, you know, call a policeman. Okay, some of the commentators tried to justify Moshe's killing the Egyptian when it says he looked around to see if anybody was there. He was looking for a policeman. You know, equivalent of a policeman. See if anybody could help. Well, you know, maybe he was. But he looked this way and that, and he saw there was no man, so he slew the Egyptian. It seems logical to assume that he was looking around to see if he was unobserved. But he might have been looking for Billy the policeman. He just might have. The more credible interpretations point to what philosophers would call natural law. He just knew that you're allowed to defend a life with a blow. But whatever post-facto explanations can be found, I don't think we can avoid saying that he acted without thinking. The narrative that follows makes it hard to deny that his act was, if not actually illegal, was surely unwise. He shouldn't have intervened to punish a local citizen on behalf of a slave. If we want to claim that he was acting according to natural law, we would be referring to what in cognitive science would be called embodied knowledge, something everyone knows without being taught. Is it innate knowledge, cognitive scientists would ask? As it happens, there's a really interesting explanation from developmental biology about where an innate sense of justice comes from. Now, all of you have small children or know small children, and you know how early they know what's not fair. Right? You know, real early. And it takes a while until they move from, it's not fair because I didn't get the bigger piece, to, you know, being able to see between maybe two other people what's not fair. Usually it's based first with themselves. But they, you know, is this something natural that we just know by our bodies? And that's what the biologist said. John Rawls, authority here on law, says that justice is fairness. And Victor Smithacek, who's a biologist, says that fairness grows out of our bodily understanding of balance. In normal development, children learn how to balance their bodies in relation to the Earth's gravity. And most important, they learn how to recognize imbalance and correct for it. And the theory is that this bodily knowledge of balance, this ability to figure out where, you know, how to adjust your own weight when things aren't smooth, it scales up to an understanding of fairness and justice. And the reason, I mean, it's a completely unprovable hypothesis, but I just have to interrupt to say that it's a completely embodied hypothesis. It's a material hypothesis. There's no going up on Mount Sinai and getting any law. There's no jumping up on a horse to heaven and getting any law. That's not part of the biologist's thinking. Okay? So if you don't have some external source, what have you got for law? How do you understand natural law? Only from what you've got from your body. Your body is evolved to know how to balance things. And especially it's important to notice, which will be important later in the discussion, it's imbalance that you need to, you know, it's not only enough that you can balance, it's that you're very sensitive to imbalance. Okay? and you react very quickly to imbalance. That's because you see it as needing correction. If we had different bodies, things would be different, but the assumption is that there's simply no other source of abstract knowing, including morality. There has to be a bodily source, which is scaled up. Natural law, then, biological law, says that Moshe saw something unfair, and he wanted to correct it. That's what it means to claim that he was acting according to natural law. Verse 13 continues. The next day, Moshe sees two Hebrews fighting together, and he interrupts them. He said to him, that was in the wrong. Why do you smite your fellow? I didn't even remember what I wrote myself. And the man says, who made you? Okay, prince and judge, after us. Are you going to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? The Torah itself relates only to one of the implications created by this question. The next line, and Moshe feared and said, surely this thing is known. Moshe now understands that Paul knows and seeks to kill him, so he sensibly flees to Midian. But what about the other implications? The Torah does not relate right there, at any rate, to the substance of the question, which is very important, the substance of the question, because indeed they're right. Moshe has no authority over them, no right to judge who was right and wrong, or who does or doesn't deserve to be punished, because they're operating with no laws, except maybe balance. They're not operating in any jurisdiction. So if Moshe is being accused of acting without authority, we must assume that there's an authority, and it's not him. He's acting according to a natural law, and it's not appropriate because there probably is an applicable jurisdiction. There is a law that applies, but he isn't part of it. The third incident takes place in another area, which maybe there's a different law over Midian, a different jurisdiction, but again, one in which Moshe has no authority beyond what his strong arm provides. He's still an outlaw, as he himself describes himself, a stranger in a strange land. There at a well, he still seems to be quick to interrupt the actions of others uninvited and to threaten violence. He chases away some bullying shepherds and he helps the daughters of Midian to water their sheep and he wins a bribe. Now, many of the interpretations of these events claim one after another that the events the Torah has chosen to portray show what a good man Moshe is, and how concerned he is for justice, and thus how suited he is to be a leader. Nahama Leibowitz cites many of them. However, in at least two of the above incidents, if not all three, Moshe was acting illegally outside the law. We have only the slightest hint from the second of the three that there was some other law, but it was not clearly one he could turn to. So what I would like to propose is that the real issue isn't Moshe's good nature, his concern for the underdog. It's the importance of law and really how bad it was to be without a law, to have to depend on banging people and pushing them away. I would bolster my claim from the Midrash of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, which Josh sent to me. When Paro heard about Moshe killing the Egyptian, he sought to kill him. Moshe, he says, natan nafsho. Then Masal Nafsho. He risked or offered his life for Mishpat, or for civil justice. And so I'll try to expand a little and figure out what was he risking his life for. What did that mean here? He risked his life. If Moshe killed the Egyptian in revenge and Paro seeks to kill him also in revenge, then his life was indeed in danger. And that's what he thought, and that's why he left. But as I said before, this retributive kind of justice is low, uncivilized, embodied kind of justice. It's what you resort to when you can't expect justice from the system. And it's, for example, Hamlet. Okay. Now, suppose your father's ghost appears to you and it tells you that the serpent that stung thy father's life now wears his crown. Okay. So, what can you do? Can you appeal to the serpent himself and say, no, where justice, my father was killed, because the justice system is in the hands of the criminal. And indeed, this is always the case in situations of revenge. And people can't expect justice in any kind of a system like that. And then what they have to do, as they always say, is take the law into their own hands. And I can't emphasize enough, since my particular view is always this question of embodiment, that, you know, physical, how things come through the body rather than just how you define them abstractly. That's what one is reduced to without law. Without being in a proper jurisdiction with a proper law, you're reduced to the strength of your own hands. That's all you have to do, and your sense of fairness or justice or balance. Okay? Hands is not a metaphor in this sense, that when people act, they feel they have no choice but to act outside the law. The good thing about the law, then, is it, when it works, it's a move up to words. It's words instead of hitting. I mean, that's what we, back to the four-year-olds, you know, I mean, we try to, three-year-olds do, try to get them not to hit and instead to speak. It turns out to be very hard, actually. Not really hard with three-year-olds. It's hard with all together to get them to give up on hitting, on violence. But what I think is happening here is that God sees the necessity of getting Moshe and all the Jews out of a bad situation and into a situation where they have a real law of their own, and they can live by it. Moshe is outside the law. Paro is above the law. And it's not good for Moshe, even though he's in a very special position in Egypt. And it's surely not good for the Jews. Living lawlessly, remember also the Meyaldot had to lie. Okay, they had no choice in that situation. And Moshe had to kill. Slaves don't expect to be protected against beatings by the same legal system that enslaved them. I mean, they're just, and it isn't only the lowly slave who has no protection, because when Paro decided to pursue and kill Moshe, even an adopted prince had no recourse from the monarch's prerogative. Paro could make any law he wanted, and the Jews had to follow or be physically punished. When he decided to allocate insufficient building material, when he wanted the midwives to kill the boy children, and then when he allowed everyone to kill the children, there's no appeal. The life of a slave isn't only unpleasant and harsh, but it's arbitrary and it's insecure, and there's no rules that can't be changed tomorrow. 16th century England, Sir Thomas More. Some of you may know him from the Robert Bolt's play, A Man for All Seasons. Okay. Some of you may know him from the recent book by Hilary Mantel, Wolf Hall. He was a lawyer, and he was very active in the debate over what was the changes of jurisdictions, the problems in England. And he said that I won't explain the whole situation, but he said that if you were living without a law, if you were at the mercy of a judge who could decide anything he wanted, you were no better than a slave. He used that collection. And that was the issue in England. There was common law, and then there were prerogative courts that were controlled by the king and chancery. And in those courts, the judges could throw out the jurisdiction of the common law courts. And there was no law for them. There was no limit to what they could do. They could just make their own decisions. And so Moore said this was like... the chancery courts, what they call the equity courts in England, could take someone out of jail who had been put in jail by a common law court. They could forgive them penalties. They could simply undo. And they weren't an appeals court. Okay? They weren't an appeals court. They were a separate court. And if you didn't like what had happened to you in the common law court, you just tried your luck elsewhere. It's more complicated than that. But basically, they had the whole purpose of that was not to have to be able to take exceptional cases and deal with them. So there were no rules. There were no laws. So that's what Thomas More was complaining about. But James insisted on his prerogative as God's deputy on earth to act outside and above the law. The king simply said, I and my assistants, not what does he call you, his chancellor, and my appointed chancellor who holds the great seal, he can issue mercy to whoever he wants, no matter what the law is. What he said. And so there was no law in that area of law, and that was what the Jews did not have in Egypt. They had no law. The Jews in Egypt lived as minorities often have to do, as Jews lived in Europe, as outsiders inside someone else's law. They could easily become victims of others' violence, and they needed to resort to it themselves. The Jews in Egypt were living the life of undocumented aliens. You know, they were Sudanese refugees in Tel Aviv. Moshe's actions, I submit, are recorded in the Torah not to give us evidence of his good nature, but as evidence that God himself now is reading the parlous state of the Jews. And Moshe's three acts are summons to God himself, that it's time to get him and the people out of Egypt and get them the needed documentation at Har Sinai. Okay? They will become a people who have agreed to a social contract, and then they're on their way to the place where that there is a jurisdiction, their own land. That's not odd enough, that part of it. This is the other part. Remember I said to you that you have to be able to recognize, it's not enough to balance, you have to be able to recognize imbalance and know how to correct for it. So the next interesting step in thinking about law is that once there's a law and once there's a place in which it applies, there are going to be people who break the law. And the community has to police this. The community has to be alert and have a way of correcting itself. And, of course, the Torah already specified that, you know, the need for judges and the need for punishment. Now, think even the smallest group, think in terms of the evolution of social groups from human social groups. Even the smallest group has to have agreements about who does what and who takes care of what. And how they'll cooperate to survive. They have a social contract of some primitive. I don't mean an 18th century social contract. I mean a much more basic kind of social contract. An important, interesting thing is that people cooperating can do more. And what's more, they can take care of people who can't contribute. Okay? That's really nice. I mean, they can take care of babies. They can take care of old people who can't contribute if they all agree on what they're supposed to do. But what about non-contributing members who we might call freeloaders, who, you know, who could work, who can't, who don't? Defectors is the official word for that in cognitive science. Defectors from the system. Well, there's actually got a point, and it's a mathematical issue of how many defectors in any one kind of system you can put up with. I mean, if you turn right on a red light in the middle of the night, you know, it doesn't really matter too much. If everybody starts to turn right on red lights in the middle of a big city, you better make the law adjust or make the people stop doing it. You have to have conventions about these. It becomes actually a mathematical issue of how much defection a society can put up with at any one point. But there's got to be a point at which there are too many defectors, and if an Inca emperor, for example, takes too much of the wealth of his people, and he has too many people working just for him in his own non-productive court, and he's throwing too many virgins into the volcano also at the same time, you know, eventually the society can't continue like that, can't go on. I know this is a sensitive subject to the support of non-productive sectors of the population, but let's leave that, you know, for next year. Societies always do support children and elderly non-contributors, but what about, you know, the ones who just cheat? Well, it turns out that there are at least two groups here. There's a group of people who cheat. There are a group of people who don't cheat, but who don't call on, who don't point out the people who do, okay? Like, really what everybody should be doing is saying, stop that, I see you're cheating and you don't do it. You know, you're getting away, don't take extra cake or something. Not enough for everybody. But there are people who, although they'll follow the rules themselves, they won't actually turn other people in. You know? Although there are people who will, even at their own cost, and there's been some research done, they do it with game theory. They do very interesting things with game theory where they show that people will even take a loss to show up somebody who's being unfair. How does it work? Does anybody know what this, know what I'm talking about? There's this research where I give you $100 and I say, share it with your wife. And you say, oh, you know, so she knows she would like 50, right? She has in mind, but she'd take 40. If you, and I say you could do whatever you want, and you give her $1 and you keep 99, she might just throw it back at you and say, no, I'm not going to take $1. And that's what the people have an idea of what's fair, and they will even take a loss. She should take $1, right? It's more than she had before, but she might not. Right? So there's always this question now about how societies manage unfairness, which they are finding some mathematical ways of investigating. I mean, it's all, you know, they're all beginning at it. There are people who, we know there are people who will stop at accidents on the road and other people who won't, right? Some people will go to some extent to help others. So that, in fact, gets into the whole question of altruism, which I can't even begin to talk about here. But what societies, as they evolve, what they decide finally to do is what's called, when they get a little bigger than 6 or 7 people, they decide to have what they call pool punishment. Okay? We'll pay, we'll have a police force, I don't have to arrest anybody, I don't have to point anybody out for doing anything wrong, I just call the police. And they have judges and they'll do it, and the hangman is not guilty for killing the person who has to be hanged. Okay? That's the system we're going to evolve. And that's called pool punishment. Okay? And so just as boots come with laces, okay, legal systems come with rules about how people are to be punished, how you're supposed to keep the number of defectors down so that the society stays stable, and how to maintain that stability without revenge killings. To live under a settled law is an advance. It's better to discuss things than to be violent. It's better to have judges instead of to use your fists. And now I want to go back to Rabbi Shimon's Midrash. Remember, he says that Moshe natan nafsho and masav nafsho. He risked or he offered his life for mishpat, for justice. Since one of the proof texts is the verse, he looked here and there and saw no man, I first assumed that the Midrash referred to the risk Moshe took in risking punishment, alluded to by Paro's pursuit of Moshe after he killed the Egyptian. But I say now that Moshe Natan Nafsho means that Moshe accepted what God offered. He accepted the job of leader and judge. He accepted his life work. He gave his life to the task of bringing his people from a state of lawlessness to a state of law. A state meaning a jurisdiction, a place where the laws and the punishments apply. That was the plan, as the second paragraph of the Shema reminds us. It was identified living by the law with living safely and fruitfully in a specific place. The Torah would have its jurisdiction, its extension in Eretz Yisrael. Now, the Midrash that I marked in the Nechama Leibowitz book is a lovely, a story. It's from a 19th century collection called I think, a Petirat Moshe, about the death of Moshe.
You want me to read it?
Yeah. Come forward so everybody can hear you here. It's very sweet about, I mean, this is, here's, we know about Avram arguing with her. This is one about Moshe. He's on Mount Nebo, and he's arguing with God. Yeah. Slow.
Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Moshe, ben mi ata? Amar lo ben Amram. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ve'Amram ben mi hu? Amar lo ben Yitzhar. Yitzhar ben mihu, amar lo ben kehat, v'kehat ben mihu, amar lo ben levi, amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, nishar mehem shum adam chai, amar lo, kulam metu, amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, v'ata rotze lichyot? Amar lo, ribono shel olam, adam harishon ganav v'achal ma shelo ratita v'kanasta alav mita, v'ani ganavti klum lefanecha? וכבר כתבת עליי, עבדי משה בכל ביתי נאמן. ואיך אמור? אמר לו הקדוש ברוך הוא, כלום אתה גדול מנוח? אמר לו, כן. נוח הבאת על דורו מהמבול, ונוח לא ביקש רחמים על דורו. ואני אמרתי, ואתה אם תישא חטאתם ממעין, וכן הנה מספרך אשר כתבת. אמר לו, כלום אתה גדול מאברהם, שניסיתי אותו ב10 ניסיונות, אמר לו, אברהם יצא ממנו ישמעאל, שיעבדו בניו את בניך. אמר לו, אתה גדול מיצחק? אמר לו, יצחק יוצא מחלציו, מי שיחריב את ביתך, ובניו יהרגו את בניך, קוניך ולוייך. אמר לו הקדוש ברוך הוא, כלום אמרתי לך שתהרוג את המצרי? אמר לו משה, ואתה הרגת כל בכורי מצרים? ואני אמות בשביל מצרי אחד? אמר לו הקדוש ברוך הוא, אתה תומא אליי במית ומחיה? כלום אתה יכול להחיות כמוני?
So I take that, I'm just concluding now by saying, I take that to support my argument that Moshe did the wrong thing by killing the object. I mean, there's no amount of discussion about it. He did the wrong thing, and he was punished for it. And I also take it to be evidence, in case we needed it, that the life of slaves in Egypt and Moshe's royal connections didn't exempt him. The life outside the law is not just a hard life, but it's a life in which there's no chance to live a moral life. And that's what they needed. They needed not just to get out from under the burdens of working very hard, but they needed law very much, and they needed a jurisdiction in which to live that law.